This is recorded in the home of Dean Emeritus Glenn L. Jenkins, Dean of the School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Education at Purdue University, on July 10th, 1972. The interview is between Dean Emeritus Jenkins and R.B. Eccles of the Department of History. It's for the use of the Purdue University Archives. Well, Dean Jenkins, let's start out at the beginning. Will you tell us where you were born and your elementary education, high school, college?
I was born on a farm near Sparta, Wisconsin, in the unglaciated hills of the southwestern part of the state. And the farm was a dairy farm. We knew what it was to get up early in the morning and work long hours in this, in operating the farm.
Did you have a large family?
I was the youngest of five children. My three brothers and one sister. My father had been married once previously, so that but his first wife had been tubercular, and those children had passed away, so that there was none of the former family alive. It was in this farm environment that I grew up and received my primary education in what was known as the district school, a one-room schoolhouse a half mile from our home. And we walked to and from this school. The teacher, as a rule, was a girl who'd had 2 years of normal school education. She taught eight grades, and each grade would move to the front of the room, recite, go to the blackboard and do so-and-so, and go return to their seats, and carry out the assignments such as she gave them, chiefly arithmetic, writing, and reading, geography, and some things of that sort. I attended that grade school, as I say, until I completed it, and then I went to a town of Lynn, 3 miles from our farm, and took an examination for entrance into the high school. Each student had to pass that exam to gain entrance. I passed it, and the next year I entered high school in Sparta, Wisconsin, 8 miles from our farm. And there I worked my way through high school by acting as what you might call chore boy for a doctor and his family. As I lived in their home, had my room and board there, receiving such money as I received otherwise from home, I cut the grass, shoveled the walk, fired the furnace, cleaned out the ashes from the old coal furnace in those days, got up early Monday mornings and did the laundry. He had a cow that was maintained by another doctor brother of his about a quarter mile away, and I went there every morning, milked the cow and got the milk back, things of that sort, to work my way through high school. Nevertheless, I lived very comfortably there, a very fine family, and a very fine part of my education.
You did this for 4 years?
For 4 years.
Did you take any special curriculum in high school, or just a general college prep?
I took a general college curriculum, fortunately, with Latin and German and English each year, and mathematics. I took advanced mathematics, which was pretty good for a high school in those days. My two older brothers, then when I finished high school, that was in 17, war had broken out, and war played an important part in my life. Two older brothers had already entered the service, and so when I graduated from high school, many of my classmates entered the service, but I was asked to come home and help on the farm, where I was very much needed. I then went home and stayed there until Thanksgiving time. The harvest was over, and I wanted to go to Madison, Wisconsin, where a brother then had been, and he'd had a job above a drugstore where he was working his way through. And when I got to, so I left home on the farm in a Thanksgiving time of 1917, went to Madison and got this, took his place, and he entered the service. I lived there throughout my college years, except when I got in graduate work, and worked for my acted as what the best title would be, janitor of the drugstore.
Well, now, when did you enter Wisconsin?
Well, this is the next step now.
I see.
This was at Thanksgiving time. The first semester was underway in 17. I went down there in order to get his job. Somebody had to take it, you see. This is an opportunity. The job paid $25 a month and a room above the drugstore. And $25 a month was almost enough to live on in those days. So I had my daytime left, and I went, and the war had broken out. I got a job in the Gissolt Machine Company and went out there and worked as a machinist from Thanksgiving time until the second semester started in February. 22 cents an hour I was a machinist, and I ran a drill press. I then entered the University of Wisconsin at the beginning of the second semester of the year 1917-18. This was 18 now, it was February. And I entered as a pre-medical student because I had worked for this doctor and gotten an interest in medicine. Went through the semester and carried the regular pre-med curriculum. At the end of June, I was looking for a job, and I went to work for an ice company as I got a job there, delivering ice to households, driving a team of horses with an ice wagon. And being a strong country boy, I carried ice on my shoulder up to the second floor and third floor and flats and delivered to butcher boxes and all sorts of things. At the end of the summer, that was the Conklin Ice Company. And at the end of the summer, and I still was getting up, of course, and janitoring this drugstore all summer. At the end of the summer, the war pressure was on. I was, of course, registered for the draft. And I entered the Student Army Training Corps. That was an officer's training corps, really, at Madison. This was September 1918. The war was over in November, and I was discharged at the end of November. I then made a pretty realistic assessment of my situation and couldn't see how I could possibly see my way through medical school financially. I was able to get along, but medical school was expensive then as now. And so I decided to change over into pharmacy. I had gotten to working in the drugstore. I got to see what it was like. And so I made the shift in curriculum. And that was my getting underway in Madison in the program that I eventually resulted in my life work.
And you took your undergraduate pharmacy at Wisconsin?
At Wisconsin. I started then in the pharmacy curriculum in the fall of 1918. I finished this first semester work, 1718, and then I started. Wait, now in the fall of 18, I was in the SATC, and in the second semester, I entered pharmacy. So I was a mid-year man. Now I continued in the School of Wisconsin and got what they called a graduate in pharmacy degree in 1921. This was for a two-year course that one could qualify for admission to the profession educationally. But I decided that was enough education, and I went on and took the Bachelor of Science degree in 1922 with my credits. And I, in the meantime, summers, I had been working for the H.J. Heinz Company as manager of a pickle station. I'd gotten this job and went out into Sparta, Wisconsin, managed that station where I had about 32 men under me. I managed the one in Rockland, Wisconsin, and one up in Arpin, Wisconsin, three different stations. And here the Heinz Company would form contracts with the growers, and they would bring pickles in, and we'd sort them, run them over the table, and we'd put them down as salted pickles and as dills, finished dills. And after getting my BS degree, I did this for one summer, since I had no immediate job. And while up there, they offered me a job to go with the H.J. Heinz Company and go through a training program, departmental-wise, over the ketchup division and the cider division. A two-year program and a full-time job in the training, and then a career with Heinz. Very fine company, and I was about to give my commitment to them when I got a long-distance call from the man who was head, not the dean, since they had no dean of pharmacy then, the director of the course in pharmacy, offering me an opportunity to come back and take graduate work up in Wisconsin. This was Dr. Edward Kremers, who later became my major professor, and I worked under him until I got my PhD. I decided to go back and take graduate work rather than go with Heinz, and this was a decisive turn in my life. Now let's hold it for just a moment.
All right, just a
I'll
second.
Check and see if the...
We were off the tape for a moment, Dean Jenkins. Now we're back on.
Very all right. Good. We're back on, and we're in graduate school back at Wisconsin. And I selected Dr. Edward Kremers as my major professor. Graduate school at Wisconsin at that time consisted of three areas, pharmacy, pharmaceutical chemistry, and pharmacognosy. Very few majored in anything except pharmaceutical chemistry. And Dr. Kremers was an outstanding man who had gotten his PhD in Germany. And at the time, Wisconsin was the only school offering the PhD degree, graduate degree, in this country. I started out as a graduate fellow. That is, when he called me by phone, I was offered a position as Hollister Fellow, H-O-L-L-I-S-T-E-R, and this was a very nice fellowship for those days. It paid about $600 per year, and it was a teaching fellowship, so that I had to do some teaching to earn my pay. At the end of that year, I was made an assistant instructor with many of the duties now carried out by a graduate teaching assistant, but I was an assistant instructor directly under Dr. Kremers, and so got experience under him. I took all of my work under him for the next 4 years because my graduate work was strung out. I spent my summers working for the Heinz Company for 1 or 2 years, but most of the time I transferred working into the drugstore and in my graduate work summers as well as during the year. And so, working along this way, I got my Master of Science degree in 1923 and my PhD in 1926.
What was the subject of your thesis?
A phytochemical study of Datura stramonium. The Datura stramonium is what is known as pig weed out here in Indiana, grows in the cornfields, and it was a big subject of research in 1918 when Eli Lilly Company harvested tons and tons of it to extract atropine, a drug which had only been available from Germany previously, and was a tremendous shortage of it here due to the war.
Yes, of course it
was. As a graduate student in my last year, I had become responsible for two or three courses, and I had a graduate student of my own. And I selected a young lady by the name of Serena Forberg. She worked with me and had a research project. I don't recall what it was now. But she was so good at washing dishes, I decided to make it permanent. And so we were married at the end of her graduate year in June 1926. He discontinued graduate work then, and we proceeded to raise a family, having our first child in December 1927. I became a licensed pharmacist, incidentally, at Wisconsin in 1928, based on my retail experience and education. After getting my PhD in 1926, I continued as a full-time instructor for the year 1926-27, and then accepted a position at the University of Maryland. And that starts a new period in my career. We moved to Baltimore, Maryland. I went there in September 1927, found a place for us to live, and my wife followed me in a few months after I'd gotten located there. Let me hesitate just a moment here and catch my breath. Figure where. The School of Pharmacy at Maryland was a very different institution than the University of Wisconsin. The school was located at the corner of Lombard and Green Street with the medical, law, and dental schools in an old building, an old church building, and a remodeled box factory. The facilities were very, very poor. The front door outlet was onto the sidewalk, and there was no campus whatsoever. Members of the faculty scattered throughout the city of Baltimore, and if we visited a fellow faculty member, it often meant a half-hour ride across the city. We taught heavy teaching loads, and I was brought there by a man who had been the first PhD in pharmacy at Wisconsin, who was Dean A.G. DeMay, and I was specifically assigned the problem to develop sound graduate work at Maryland. He was very enthusiastic and gave excellent support. Interestingly, as pertains to my further career, at that time a graduate council had been established at Maryland. And as far as I know, this was the time when graduate councils were being established throughout the universities in this country, 1927. And I was appointed to the graduate council to represent the professional schools from Baltimore, and which had practically no graduate work. This had a great influence upon my future thought, because I appreciated graduate work, and we sought to build a strong program at Maryland. I then developed both research and instruction at the graduate level, especially in pharmaceutical chemistry, but I taught the first course in pharmacology, which was a graduate level course there, because I had minored in pharmacology at Wisconsin. Later, they brought in a full-time man in pharmacology, and I concentrated on chemistry. But nine men finished their PhDs under me in the 9 years I was at Maryland. And they went on, practically all of them went out in either into direction of research or into teaching, and so they were influential in turn in developing graduate work.
What was your specialty in giving graduate work?
My specialty was pharmaceutical chemistry, drug chemistry, mostly phytochemical, we called it first, and then synthetic work. And I established the Then I became very active in association work at that time, in addition to my graduate work. Baltimore was very fortunate in that it was the headquarters of the American Pharmaceutical Association. And
you sort of had them over your looking over your shoulder, didn't
you? That's right. They were right there. The secretary of the APHA, the editor of the Scientific Journal, they were right there in Baltimore. And it was the crossroads, as we used to say, between Washington and New York. And so I met very influential people in the pharmaceutical field. Very fortunate for me. In addition to my heavy teaching load and so on, and I wrote my first book. I got to work on it almost at once. I was teaching in the field of drug standards. And this became my first specialty, quantitative pharmaceutical analysis, or chemistry, the assay of drugs, if you wish. And I wrote a book on the subject, published by McGraw-Hill Book Company in 1931. The co-author was Dr. A.G. DeMay. I did the writing, and he acted as critic, and he had an excellent command of the English language, so I was very fortunate in that. I became active in associations, that is, as a participating member, and therefore became well known in the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, for example, where I received committee appointments and offices as a young man. I was active in establishing high standards for drugs, and so I was made a member of the National Formulary Revision Committee at an early age, and this gave me prestige. I also became active in the pharmacopeia work. The pharmacopeia sets standards for drugs also, and there are two compendia which are official under the U.S. Food and Drugs Act, and I collaborated with the Food and Drug Department of the government, which gave me quite a bit of prestige in that way. Over the 9 years then, they were building years in research, scholarly work, and heavy load of teaching, and raising our family. We had our first three children were born in Baltimore. Our oldest daughter, Betsy as we called her, Serena Elizabeth, our oldest son, Thomas, and our youngest son, Glenn L. Jr. Later, a fourth child, Carol, was born in Minneapolis. I'll come to that soon. While at Maryland, I developed a patent on the calcium gluconate, which is used against milk fever in cows. That is, I had been working on a synthetic product, methionic acid, and we found that this solubilized calcium gluconate, and they had to get large quantities of calcium gluconate into the vein of a cow, and since it was insoluble, this was a valuable discovery for a short time. About one day in the summer of 1936, I was playing golf in a hot summer afternoon, and got a message sent to me on the golf course to come in a hurry. I had a long-distance call, and I was invited to come to the University of Minnesota as professor of pharmaceutical chemistry and head of the department, and asked to come out there for an interview. I went, accepted the call from the president, who was a good friend, incidentally, of Dr. Edward Elliott later, but I was happy to get back to a campus school. And I was brought there again with the very specific charge to develop a sound program of graduate education. I was happy to go because Maryland just did not seem to have the resources.
And also, you're getting back in the country that you were brought up in.
That's right. That's right. Where I could hunt and fish and do some of the things I like to do.
A boy brought up in central and northern Wisconsin is not going to be out of place in Minneapolis.
That's right. Yes, that was a very, very wonderful place to be. So we went to the University of Minnesota and set out to develop a program. Again, while the university was fine, I got good cooperation from the departments of organic chemistry, which was very important to us. I tried to cooperate with the medical group, and they were wonderful in lip service, saying they would cooperate, but very short on performance. This, in my opinion, is one reason I'll come to that in the strength of Purdue. We do not have a medical school. Wherever pharmacy school is on the campus with medicine, the pharmacy school is subordinated, and there's tremendous jealousy between departments.
And there should not be, should there?
There should not be, but there always is.
As a child of two MDs, I know the importance of
the lip service is there, but yes. The performance is not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the great fault. Well, while I was at Minnesota, I did develop a sound program of graduate education, but one thing became apparent to me. I was the only member other than the dean on a 12-month appointment. All of the rest of them, on the last day of classes, took off for their summer cottages on the lake or elsewhere, and they didn't come back until the day before classes were to start in the fall. And they could not direct research in a proper manner. I did have one or two who had some graduate students, and I would carry their load for the summer, taking over their students. Also, the dean of the school had never been through the graduate program, and a man who has not had been through the mill of graduate work has no business directing a graduate program. He just doesn't understand the problem. And so, after 5 years, and having turned out another group of some 7 PhDs under my own supervision, and having pursued scholarly work in drug standards, and I had started and almost finished another book known as Organic Medicinal Products, in cooperation with Dr. Walter Hartung. And I finished that after I came here to Purdue in its first edition.
Now, sir, we will have in the, may I just interrupt long enough, to say for the benefit of the tape, we will have all of your publications added in the appendix.
I'll have a list of all the publications.
Thank you. All right.
At least the scientific publications.
Yes.
Now,
I
haven't got a compilation of the others, but I can make one.
All right.
Then I came up there. I was at Minnesota, and again it was in August, when I received a call from Purdue. Dr. Elliott was on the phone and asked me if I'd be interested in becoming dean at Purdue. I really had no ambition to become a dean. I'd turned down two or three in schools that I didn't have a potential for graduate work or much potential that I could see. But he asked me to come down here, and I knew Purdue had a pretty good reputation at the time. So I came here for an interview, and we got along very beautifully together. He assured me he would give me full support for a graduate program. Purdue already had one. In fact, they were giving graduate work in pharmacy, pharmaceutical chemistry, and pharmacognosy. Pharmacognosy was weak. They'd never turned out a PhD, but they had a program, no professor, who didn't attract graduate students. And after talking with him, and he gave me we arrived at a fair basis on salary. He made a verbal commitment to give me full backing, and the building facility was insufficient, and he said he'd do something about it just at the first opportunity. He knew the need, and so I came here in September of 1941 as professor, as dean of the School of Pharmacy and professor of pharmaceutical chemistry. I was both a teaching dean in the real sense of the word, because when I came here, I was one of 5 members of professorial rank in the School of Pharmacy, where we had about 120 undergraduate students, and there were 15 graduate students, I believe, that's the number, already here. And they had given some PhDs. Incidentally, I might mention that before I came here, the first woman to get a PhD from Purdue was Alice Hayden, and she'd gotten it in pharmaceutical chemistry. So that there was no discrimination against women. I came here then to develop graduate work, and unfortunately, in December of 1941, the war broke out. And, of course, the enrollment, which had been up, very nice enrollment, very fine group of students, they disappeared, and disappeared into service and elsewhere, and in a short time, the enrollment was down. I think it went down as low as 42 students. Hold it for just a second.
All right, we'll go off the tape for a moment.
When I came to Purdue, the school had 120 undergraduates and 15 graduate students, and a professorial faculty of 5 professors and 2 instructors, and there were 2 service personnel and a librarian. The war caused the enrollment to decrease, and in 1945 only two students were graduated, and the total enrollment was down to 41 undergraduates, most of them women. Some of our faculty were assisting in other areas of the university where there was demand, for example, Decay in physics and Charlie Lee in chemistry. The commitments to have improvements in the building, of course, fell through, and we were glad to survive in those war years.
As I remember, you got a temporary building north of the old pharmacy.
That's building. Right. Mm-hmm. But we did continue our graduate work, and we got some policies established. And incidentally, one that goes back to our early commitment with Dr. Elliott. He agreed to have all professorial members of the pharmacy faculty on a 12-month basis if we're going to develop sound graduate work. We made this elective for the older members of the faculty, and Drs. Zufall and Lee elected to stay on the 10-month basis. All the others, members, went on a 12-month basis, so we had a working faculty for graduate work. The graduate work was then offered in these areas, and we reached out to get pharmacology, and this had been part of our agreement. Pharmacology had been taught by Dr. Heaston in the School of Science, and Dr. Elliott agreed that this properly belonged to the School of Pharmacy, and Dr. Heaston agreed. And so it was transferred to the School of Pharmacy as an area of instruction in 1943, and it was approved as an area by the Graduate Council for the PhD degree. The war ended, as all wars seemingly do, and in 1947 the pharmacy annex was built. We had considerable argument about what pharmacy would get, but I made as strong a case as I could for space, and through Dr. R.B. Stewart, we received what was known as Building Number 26, the Pharmacy Annex, 10,000 square feet of space, and into it we moved the Department of Pharmacy and what had been established, the Department of Bionucleonics, and the Pharmacology Department. Leaving the main building, or main pharmacy building, for pharmaceutical chemistry, pharmacy, and what we were calling pharmacy administration.
Was the pharmacological nucleonics, was that a war produced?
No, study? No. Pharmacology was a subject taught in medical schools to teach medical students something about drugs. Strangely enough, pharmacology was not being taught in most pharmacy schools, and I'll talk a little about the philosophy of or the general principles of pharmacal education in a moment. Bionucleonics was unknown. The term was coined here at Purdue, and it came a little bit later. Have you talked to Dr. Christian yet?
No, I haven't. I doubt if I will, so I'd appreciate if you'd put
Now, the first graduate student I had 2 early graduate students. One was Hubert Murphy, whom I inherited. He was almost through with his graduate work. And he went in with Eli Lilly, and he's still with them as a scientist there. The other was John Christian. And John was really my first full-time graduate student at Purdue. He worked under me all the way through, got his PhD. And he got interested in, we were doing work on radioactive substances, using it as a tool in research to measure the absorption of drugs through the skin, for example. John became interested, and I don't recall, I'm sure it's in the correspondence, and he would know. We had an opportunity to have him go to Oak Ridge, Tennessee as a special student to study this new radioactive thing and the hazards and get well informed about it. He went there and was enthusiastic, and then we sent him the next summer. He went to California, and this was a presidential permission, and we supported him financially in it as a faculty grant. He went out there to study under Lawrence. Lawrence was one of the men influential in developing the atomic bomb. So he got high-grade instruction for that time. And this, in the meantime, Elliot, this was under Hovde by the time, and Hovde and Christian together coined the term bionucleonics for the new area of instruction. John went over, I've forgotten what his suggestion was, but anyhow, Hovde said bionucleonics. I think he was the one who used the term, and so that became it. Well, we started teaching in this area and doing research, and had no equipment to speak of, but it was built up and grew and grew, and you know, today it's bigger than the School of Pharmacy was at the time when I came here. Tremendous thing.
And this is something that was unique to Purdue.
That was unique.
You might say this is a Purdue contribution.
It originated
to the world
here.
Of pharmacy.
That's right. And basically, we developed pharmacology. That is, and most importantly, we developed pharmacology in pharmacy schools. Now, I'll admit others had it. Maryland, you see, I'd started it, and they had a professor, but we really were doing it on a large scale. None today is doing in pharmacology what we are doing now.
In other words, in a sense, this is a first or leading one of the outstanding contributions of our School of Pharmacy.
No question about it. No question at all.
This is why I hear people like Dean Potter say that there should be a history of pharmacy written at Purdue as a history of the school because of its great contributions.
I think that probably would be true. We've made several very marked ones.
I'll just say just to you that there is a movement on foot that in a few years we will undertake the writing of the history of Purdue by schools,
yes,
as we have done in the past by the School of Engineering.
That would be very, very good indeed.
I'll talk to you when we're off the table, yes, about it. Excuse me.
Well, we, let me get oriented now. We got new building areas of instruction in 1941. The pharmacy building, instruction at the graduate level offered in pharmacy and pharmaceutical chemistry, pharmacology. Pharmacy annex was added, and then in 1955, the Pierce Conservatory was assigned one half to pharmacy for pharmacology, and the other half was assigned later to provide for work in pharmacognosy. This made expansion possible in both of these areas of graduate work. Then there are continuing demands. Now I'm getting ahead of my story. Other space, the overflow work, was accommodated variously in civil engineering. This was Christian's bionucleonics especially. The dairy science building and the old naval armory, we took over parts of it and elsewhere. That is, we were scattered in some seven buildings when I finished, and it continued that way until we got our new building. The school was departmentalized unofficially for purposes of instruction by certain approved programs in the graduate school. That is, pharmacy, as I've mentioned, and pharmaceutical chemistry had been approved prior to 1941. Pharmacology and pharmacognosy were approved in 1941. Bionucleonics for the PhD in 1947. Physical pharmacy in 1956. Pharmacy administration in 1957. Now, what had been pharmacy got broken down later, then into industrial pharmacy as a major, and physical pharmacy. Now it's been, we've set it up also in, I'm sure Dr. Tyler mentioned this, in clinical pharmacy. We have an area of instruction. That had been developed before he came here, but he has developed it much further along with Dr. Sprondell. Medicinal chemistry was developed as a separate department in July 1, 1963, and I was the first head of it. Now I'll go over onto another slant for a moment on this whole business of undergraduate and graduate work, the philosophy back of them and the thinking. You see, in the history of pharmacy, the old-time pharmacist had been sort of a chemist, biologist. He was a scientist who made his drugs, sometimes his chemicals, sometimes his drugs, put them together as a pharmacist. In other words, he was really a scientist in himself. Manufacturing industry, there was a revolution, and the manufacturing industry grew up following the Civil War. And all of this so-called development of drugs, that is, synthesis and putting things together, the technology was developed, and all the pharmacist was left to, they sometimes call it counting four. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, pharmacal education remained the same with all its laboratory, that is, the laboratories as much. Just discussing it with students, I used to say this, that the B.S. in pharmacy, and it's true even to this day, gets almost as much chemistry as the major in chemistry, almost as much biology as the major in biology, almost as much general education as, students in other areas, that is, economics, sociology, and so forth, get. And so our students were able to go on into, we had students actually go into strong departments of chemistry, biology, business administration, into medical schools, dental schools, and into law schools, being accepted right out with the B.S., and this was under the four-year course. So we had a very broad educational program, and my idea was that you had to have a sound, broad B.S. program in order to have a good graduate program later, if the men went on into graduate work. Then, all the time, though, I was disturbed very much in the old days by the fact that everything we did when we tried to do big things was that we were confronted with the image that pharmacy as practiced created. In other words,
it was the man who sold tires and radios over the counter.
That's right. In other words, when I would go up before the Board of Trustees to propose certain things, some of our good pharmacy representatives from big industrial companies, I won't mention names, would ask how we're still teaching the boys how to make ham sandwiches and pour soup, you see. And others, one representative of a big pharmaceutical company and a very honored man at Purdue, said, you don't need to teach or do any of this graduate work. We do all that. All you have to do is teach them how to count and pour, or pour and count it. So this was something we had to combat. And it was in the face of this image where, as I've often said, the pharmacist hangs all his linen in the front window for people to see, the dirty linen, while medicine and law and so on know how to bury theirs. We had to divorce or make a separation. And so we came up with a change in the name to the School of Pharmacy and Pharmacal Science. In other words, we still have a sound program in pharmacy to train the practitioner. And the other is to train at the graduate level. And if you're going to have a good training at the graduate level, then we had to broaden the base. And for this purpose, we had to have not only synthetic chemistry, but the chemistry of natural products, biochemistry in it. We had to have the biologies, and in that, pharmacology, toxicology. And we had to have business administration, because our men go out and become businessmen. And we had to have the clinical pharmacy for those going into hospitals. So I had this philosophy of laying this base at the bottom and then having graduate work at the top. And the incidentally, this also, I was helped immensely in all of this by things over which I had no control. That is, pharmaceutical industry in the era from 1941, when I came here, up to 1960 or thereabouts, was in the greatest upsurge in all history. That is, the development of new products that cure disease, antibiotics, synthetic drugs. Never so glorious an era. Now, it's being shot at from many directions, as you know, and criticized, the Food and Drug Administration and so forth. I sometimes say they'd sooner let a person die than to take a chance that the drug may not be perfectly safe for everybody. But I could be wrong in that. Well, we developed different areas. Industrial pharmacy, Purdue became unquestionably the leading school teaching in that area.
And what is industrial pharmacy?
Industrial pharmacy is teaching people how to use mechanical or technological methods to produce the finished product used as drugs.
It has nothing then to do with serving industry.
No, it's only that we're teaching just what the Eli Lilly Company does. In other words, not everything they do, but in the manufacture, and taking a simple illustration would be to take aspirin and convert it into a form suitable for you to swallow. This is industrial pharmacy. Now, to some of it isn't all as simple as that. Aspirin's pretty simple. But if you want to make a stable solution or a stable injectable product that's safe for a doctor or a nurse to shoot into a vein, this becomes a very different proposition. Now let's see, we fought against many hazards in this. One of the problems we had was within pharmacy itself, the old prejudice. You see, the schools had stuck to the old line of education developed way back historically, and they resisted change. So here we were teaching how to make blue ointment, that is, taking metallic mercury and triturating it in a mortar to make an ointment to apply, when blue ointment was no longer being used, long after. And I argued with our faculty, and it was a hard job as an administrator to cut down the many, many hours of laboratory work, because I claimed there was too big a gap between the education and the practice. And this is the undergraduate level. Here we were training men, giving them organic laboratory practice and a quantitative analysis, the assay. And no pharmacist actually assays his drugs anymore. He depends on the manufacturer to do it. Now, I claim this is for the graduate work.
In other words, the pharmacist, if he can read, he can and knows the meaning of the terms, he can get by.
Well, and the professor up in front of a class can demonstrate how you do this and how you do that. The student can see it, but he doesn't have to learn the manipulative skill any more than they need to learn home economics. Everyone doesn't have to be an expert seamstress or work with in order to appreciate the nicer things. Well, anyhow, pharmacy is burdened down today with the obsolete holdover. It's been cleaning it out pretty well in recent years, but this was a hard fight. But the big thing has been the development of graduate work. Now, there are only a limited number of schools that have the resources for a good, sound graduate program. And Purdue, fortunately, has developed those resources. We didn't have them in physical plant for a long time, but we've got the right personnel.
In what areas do we do our best graduate work?
Well, there's no question but what pharmacology and bionucleonics are the two outstanding ones. Medicinal chemistry and pharmacognosy, which are one department now, would come in as third, industrial pharmacy as fourth, and clinical pharmacy probably as five. And those are the...
What is clinical pharmacy?
Well, clinical pharmacy is a new area that they're trying to develop. Basically, it is the idea of the pharmacist in his relationship to the consumer. And in theory, at least because the medical MD writes a prescription, and he may hand it to the nurse, or he may hand it to the patient, or in the hospital he may get it, and the patient doesn't know what on earth it is, and what, he can go to 10 doctors and get different prescriptions from each one. Some of them may interfere with the others, drugs, and very, very messy situation.
In other words, it's a relation of the pharmacist to the patient.
That's right.
And he will study the patient.
That's right.
And assist him.
That's right.
In his
all of those things. Now, so basically, then we came up to 1966. We'd been developing very well. President Howdy and the graduate others had given good support, and we had developed a strong school. We had the basis plans being laid for the pharmacy building, had the money in sight at last, provided by Purdue, partly through the sale of land that the Josiah Lilly had given to Purdue, and Howdy had made a commitment when they realized on that we would get our new building. And then Dean Tyler and the faculty carried through pretty much in the final stages of the new building. But we had established this broad program and departmentalized the school. And this is something I learned, incidentally, about Purdue. A great advantage in departmentalization. As Hovde, I got this idea once when attending one of the big faculty meetings in the fall. You know, the president's reception for new faculty, when they introduced the deans and so on. And he made the statement that he depended upon his first line of command, the deans and the heads of departments. And every time, you see, I went up to fight for budget, they always, I didn't have departments in the early days. I was fighting for a salary for a professor. When we got department,
the budget, easier to fight, isn't
we, had, we got our share of the budget much more easily. It took me a long time to become aware of that. Now, let's see, I made progress. I gradually relinquished my part in graduate work, but all told, I had over 100 people get their PhDs, about 100 get their PhDs under my direction.
That is in clinical pharmacy.
In chemical, pharmaceutical, in medicinal chemistry.
Medicinal.
That was my area.
Yeah.
I stuck to it all the way, although it shifted from emphasis on analysis in my days at Maryland and phytochemistry, and then over into synthetic chemistry in the later years. I went through a variation, and I have written, then I wrote another book or two, got involved in that. Well, I got very active in pharmaceutical affairs. Now, while at Purdue, in this development and related to it, I had very close relations with the graduate school. I was on the Committee on Post-War Planning. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but there's a published report by that committee in the university, and Dodds, Dr. Dodds, had been chairman, and Dean Young and I can't tell the rest of the name, but we worked hard on that for a long time to try to project the future of Purdue after the war, what we should emphasize. Then after that was done, I was appointed chairman of the Committee on the Reorganization of the Graduate School. And this was specifically on the recommendation of Dean Young, because he and I had cooperated, and he didn't feel that he could properly chair it, because he would be influencing something that was his own too much. And I think he felt that somebody else ought to do the work. He didn't want to do it. Anyhow, I worked hard at that, and it went for a long time. And we developed the program that is substantially the graduate school today. In the beginning, it was 27 departments. I don't know how much it many now, but this represented every department, really, of graduate work in the university. It was represented on the council. And then a graduate dean, and they put in assistant deans after that. But we avoided the problem they have in some major universities where the graduates faculty becomes sort of a prima donna faculty, and there's a fight to be elected to it, and young men are kept out, and so forth. And here at Purdue, pretty easy entry if a man has ability to the graduate faculty. And that was one of my important contributions, at least I so consider it. Then, for several years, I headed the Committee on Faculty Promotions. Now, the heading of it is no more important than any member, except he administers it. On the other hand, he does have something to do with policy. And I worked along with Mallop to bring in faculty status for librarians and some of the Dean of Women's Office and so forth. I give them a certain number. We set up a quota system in the beginning. I don't know if they're still holding to it or not. Then also I worked with Lachey to get proper representative for all these extension centers. He was having an awful time to get a man who worked out in an extension center appointed to a professorial rank here. There was jealousy, I think, in part. And also, the men, he had a hard time recruiting equivalent faculty out in those places. So I worked with him in that and played, I think, an important part. I helped set up the so-called system for emeritus professors. Purdue didn't used to grant the emeritus degree.
It's nice to have it.
Nice. It's a nice compliment to somebody retiring.
That is correct.
And the conditions under which we give it, see. That was set up. Then we worked on a good many things. For example, through the Research Foundation, I served on the Research Committee for years, worked on research grants. We set up the system of faculty grants. When Lynn gave money, we had these faculty summer grants, and a good many things of that sort were established. In the meantime, I got into a good many other activities, but coming back to the School of Pharmacy, I want to pick up two or three little points that were influential. At the undergraduate level, we had, and from the very beginning, a policy of non-discrimination, and in these times it's important because there's non-discrimination against women because some schools wouldn't admit women to pharmacy school. Butler wouldn't, for example, for a good many years.
And there were only two pharmacy schools in the state, Butler and Purdue.
That's all there are now.
Yes.
At one time there were
three.
There were five.
Five.
Yes, Notre Dame had one. Tri-State College up at Angola had one. Butler, the old Indianapolis College of Pharmacy, was one, and Purdue, and Valparaiso. Valparaiso had one. Valparaiso was closed out about 1939, about 2 years before I came here, and I actually had a student in the school who had started at Valparaiso, and Purdue, to try to make it easy for them to go out of the business, took over a number of their students to finish off. And I might say in that, the marked factor in reducing these schools was the American Council on Education, on pharmaceutical education, which required that each school have not less than three professors in the pharmacy faculty, namely pharmacy, pharmaceutical chemistry, and pharmacognosy.
In other words, it was raising the standards.
Raising the standards, and the others agreed not to meet it. You see, all they had was one professor they called professor of pharmacy. And very weak, it's hard to understand how weak schools of pharmacy were. That is, there were cram schools, and a lot of them operated as a cram school basis.
Didn't you have difficult state boards, or were the state boards easy to pass?
Some state boards were nothing more than paper boards. There's nothing there at all. Some, on the other hand, were tough. You see, the National Association of Boards started raising standards, but they couldn't invade a state. They only when a person tried to transfer that they could get tough.
I understand.
So we had a good many things. Well, coming back, for a good many years, we had the largest number of women of any undergraduate school in the United States. That is, this I think is almost true now, although it may not be today. The number of women has been increasing. But you see, in the old days, Illinois sent, if a daughter of a pharmacist wanted to take pharmacy, she'd come here or go to Wisconsin, because Illinois is located in that medical center, Cook County Medical Center up there. In the old days, Kentucky was located in the down the wholesale district of Louisville. Now it's at Lexington, a very nice situation. So the situation's changed. Well, I didn't want to spend too much time on that, but the first, I mentioned that the first woman to get a PhD was in pharmacy, pharmachem from Purdue. The first colored girl to get a PhD from Purdue was in pharmacology, and the first colored male to get a PhD from Purdue was in pharmacology at Purdue also. So there we had influence. Now there was another, hold it just a moment
just
there,
so move on
let
the
me
tape.
Catch my breath.
All right, we are now back on the tape.
While I was here at Purdue, I served in many capacities in pharmaceutical education and pharmaceutical associations. I became the president of the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy in 1944, and because of the war, I held it for 2 years, until 1946. At the conclusion of that time, there had been a movement, there was a movement underway to have a survey made of pharmacy. And it fell upon two men to carry the load, B.V. Christensen, then dean at Ohio State University, who was chairman of the executive committee of the Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, AACP, and I as president. We went to see to the consul, American Consul on Education in Washington, and conferred with them to see if they would underwrite it or undertake the direction. And Dr. Zook, then chairman of the council there, turned us down. We then went to the American Foundation for Pharmaceutical Education, well known in pharmacy circles, and appeared before their group on two different occasions, and we secured a grant of $100,000 to conduct such a survey, provided a satisfactory person could get be obtained to undertake it. Dr. Ed Elliott had retired from Purdue, and I was able to convince him that this was something that he could do to great advantage and furthering education.
He was an old chemist, wasn't he?
He was an old chemist in his early training, and he knew pharmacy by this time. He'd gotten to undertake some things. So we got him into it, and he spent the next 2 or 3 years of his life in the survey of pharmacy, with the assistance from a great many people who contributed freely of their time and effort. And this had a very marked influence on the future of pharmacy, because he advocated the lengthening the pharmacy curriculum for a substantial number of people. And this led to the idea of the 5-year course and the 6-year course. And I was opposed to the 5-year course for the practitioner. But it has come through, as you may know by this time, and the 6-year course is prevalent, leading to the Doctor of Pharmacy degree for undergraduates in some schools. Now, I opposed that and set up a program that I called a new program in pharmacal education, on which on which I have put out papers, and basically this was...
Will you append those papers to...
Yes, I'll try to give you a copy of what I had.
Append those to the interview.
Yeah, this was a separate, a very different approach from today. That is, my idea was that our undergraduate program would be set up for 4 years, and then a student would come back to specialize, and he would undertake options for hospital pharmacy. He might go on for a doctor of pharmacy, the so-called clinical pharmacist. retail pharmacist, he might take more business. If he wanted to go into graduate work, biological area, he'd take more biology work. If he wanted to go into chemistry, he'd take more chemical work. Well, all this sort of thing has a specialized area, but my ideas did not prevail. But that was the reason, part of the reasoning back of the changing of the school. Now, I became president of the APHA, won awards, and so forth. I can give all of that in a resume that's already in places like Who's Who and Who's Who in Education.
And will be appended here.
American Men of Science.
In other words, what field do you think you made your greatest contribution to pharmacy education?
Oh, I think basically in the stimulation of research. You see, I got an award for that, and that's the reason I use those words. I got more people into this. That is, there have been all these people who got their PhDs from Purdue. We had at one time here when I counted them up, we had 55 men of professorial rank teaching in schools of pharmacy in this country who had gotten their PhDs at Purdue. There were 15 deans who went out who had studied here under our system. And it was this training men who went out that was our great contribution. That is, nothing one could do individually. But we did attract superior students. We held high standards, gave them a pretty rigid training and indoctrination, and then sent them out. Now this, here I come to my philosophy of the future. I claim, in part, we've overtrained. This is one fault of education. We, in the early days, to make progress, we kept lengthening the curriculum and lengthening the load. This has been a great fault of medicine, and now they're learning it and reversing their trend. I don't believe in postdoctorate education, not very much anyhow. I admit there are exceptions. But a postdoctoral candidate can learn just as much on the job as he can staying on a research fellowship in the university. And he'd be paid for it instead of expending public money.
Let him go, for example, to Eli Lilly.
That's right.
And do his research in their laboratory.
And he would, if he's a good man, he'll learn more there in a year than he would right here continuing. Now, the same is true on if a person hasn't gotten, and if we're careful in selecting men, if at the end of 4 years we can't teach this student how to learn for himself, there's something wrong with our system. Now, I admit that at the graduate level, if you're going to start him on research, someone has to guide him along and show him how to proceed. Someone needs to guide him along into advanced fields of study, which are new to him. And this is valuable. But you don't need to keep lengthening the curriculum all the time in order to advance standards.
Well, do you think 3 years as an undergraduate, then going to graduate school for another 3 or 4 years is the way to go?
I think it could be done very nicely in 3 years. For the professional practice, and then have a year in which they integrate practice. You see, we have an experience requirement.
An intern year.
Intern year. Now, this could be in integrated whatever way, but it could be done in 4 years. Now, if a man wants to become a specialist and go on, just like the medical specialists and so on, they go in, and this is a very important. I'll let them have another year and give them a doctor of pharmacy or some recognition for it. But I'm very much against this continually increasing the period of education that goes on. And then I have another objection to my whole observation, and here again I know I'm in the minority, and you see it very much at Purdue. That is, we have girls in home economics, or we had, as I observed them, maybe they've changed a lot of it, spending hours taking chemistry laboratories and physics laboratories, and they don't ever intend to go into anything where they use the techniques of the laboratory. In other words, there's no close relationship between practice and education and practice.
Yes.
Now, there for some there is. There ought to be ways for them to specialize and get it. But in the future, I'm confident that pharmacy is going to come into great new eras. I don't know how to define them, but the fact is that medicine, the people are getting poor medical attention, not because a lot of physicians are not very able people, not because nurses aren't very conscientious and able, but because the doctor does his thing and then says this is it, and he doesn't know much about drugs. He isn't able to follow the patient and see whether they take their medicine regularly. The nurse sometimes doesn't understand the doctor's orders, and the pharmacist is left in the dark almost on prescription. Somewhere the patient ought to have someone through which all of this could be carried out and a little more personal. That is something of the old relationship, I think, that was common between a pharmacist and the patient in the old days, when, you know, they used to come into the drugstore and
say,
talk
Doc, fix me up.
Yeah, they talk to him. They say, well, the doctor told me to do so-and-so. What do you think? And a fellow would understand the situation and advise him. That's what they need.
Counsel with him. When the doctor writes out a placebo, he gives them the best placebo he's got.
That's right. You see. So I think there needs to be, there's an opportunity for something big to be done. But I don't know how to say it should be done, brought about.
But of course, this brings in another specialist in the life of a sick person.
Well, it could.
You've got the dentist, you've got the psychiatrist,
you've
got the doctor.
I suppose.
And now you're going to add the pharmacist.
Well,
it may be necessary, however, to do this.
I wouldn't care whether it was the pharmacist. The pharmacist is already there and playing a part. It comes again to this business, as I say, the pharmacist put his dirty linen in the window. Basically, he put his dirty linen there because if he didn't have that dirty linen, he wouldn't be able to make a living. So this is a side issue. Now, if he could cast out the dirty linen and let somebody else do that and spend his time on this consulting and...
In other words, you mean you would like to promote what, as I understand it, ethical pharmacy?
That's right.
Do away with selling tires and...
That's right. All of that. Get all of that out of the retail pharmacy. But this may evolve that way, and maybe... But in any event, the people ought to get it from some source, even if it's a specialty in nursing that follows through.
I notice that one of our big chains, Hooks, points out that although they sell flashlights and tires and so on, the real thing that they're trying to sell is medicine and medical service.
And Hooks does a pretty nice job. Yeah. Surprising thing, I used to be anti-chain store because the chain stores in the early days weren't so good. But today you get about as nice pharmaceutical service in the chain store as you get anywhere.
Is one of the great innovations putting the pharmacy into the hospital? Does that help?
Well, yes and no. There are some poor hospital pharmacies.
But the principle
is
not a bad
one. The principle is a good one. But to have a pharmacy in. One of the things against it is that the hospitals ordinarily overcharge for their drugs.
Well, they have to make money somehow.
Well, they do. They use pharmacy as a profit, and they use x-ray as profit. Inordinately heavily. That is, you go in and, they charge you by the dose, and you know if you break everything down into one, when you can buy them by the hundred, why?
The thing I always enjoy about aspirin is USP.
Yes.
And therefore it should be about 0.1 cents. But you pay for the advertising for Bayer and other such commercial.
Yes. Products. Well, on the other hand, you wouldn't want to put all the advertisers out of business.
Why, certainly not. Wouldn't think of it.
Mr.
Tyler made a point that rather shocked me in his interview. He said in a few years, we're going to have enough social service so that medicine in this country will be offered free to the patient as it is in Europe, in England, for example.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. We're drifting in that direction, you know. Some of our politicians are advocating greatly liberalized medical care treatment for people. Now, our Medicare for the aged by carrying insurance with Blue Cross Blue Shield, I could have some awfully big medical bills and wouldn't cost any more out of my pocket, I guess. On the other hand, what I complain about is I don't get very good medical care. If I call up the best resources I know and tell them I want to see Dr. So-and-so, sometimes they'll give me an appointment 4 weeks away. And if I lie a bit and say I'm in serious pain and need immediate attention, they'll crowd me in somewhere to interfere with some other patient. That means they give the other patient less time, and
I don't know
the answers to it, but I agree that I think they're going to increase the number of medical people
very greatly. Medical services making the service come from the government-supported hospital or infirmary.
Well, a medical center, medical hospital, you'll take who they put there, and
I think that this is coming.
I do too.
People attacked England and English medicine on the grounds that it's socialist. Well, let me tell you a true story. In Bristol, England, in 1937, there was an area of the town, a working-class suburb, that had 45,000 people. Now, it's a town the size of Lafayette. There was not one pharmacy or one doctor resident in that area. Now, you know why you have socialism in England, socialized medicine? And I was in England last summer, and I've never seen a healthier-looking bunch of people. So the idea of getting false teeth and glass eyes and coming to the doctors when you don't need it and so on, yes. And I think if your medical profession cooperates,
That's right.
And don't take some of the antique ideas that I was brought
up. You see, it'd be wonderful, really, if you had an institution down here, let's say a health service in West Lafayette, like our university service. And a person.
Well, I'd rather have a little better attention than some people get at the university service.
Yeah, I agree. On the other hand, if you could walk in there and get a service, you don't have to wait your turn. But if you could get it, and if you could turn then and get your prescription filled, and if you could get your glasses fitted,
right
then, and you could have it all done. But this business of making an appointment here for an examination, another place to order your glasses, and you go there and sit and wait, and then you come back to have them checked up. And then if they don't fit, you go through the whole thing again. No, we've just been through that, where we went to a doctor and had glasses. We went out to the optical company to have them filled after the prescription was put up. They fiddled around with that. We went back to the doctor to have them checked. They didn't seem to be right. We went out and had another doctor then examined to check up and get it all straightened up. Messy affair.
Well, you think then the direction may be towards socialized medicine?
I think we're definitely, the trend is in that direction.
And socialized pharmacy.
And socialized pharmacy, I think that's right. People are going to want it.
And then in this sense, this is an opportunity for pharmaceutical schools to have courses of instruction and ready to step in to take it.
I think so. They're logical people to render a good bit of paramedical service.
Well, now there's an area I haven't asked you about. Obviously, from what you've said and what we know, Dean Tyler, Purdue is one of the leading pharmacy schools in the country. What about others in the Big Ten first and then nationally? How would you rank?
Well, Wisconsin, of course, was the leader historically. They were ahead of us competitively for a good many years. They stuck too much to trying to get glory in research, that is, into postdoctoral research and so forth. And they did not broaden the base. You see, this is the failure. They stuck to medicinal chemistry and pharmacy technology. They didn't get into pharmacology. They still haven't got a decent department of pharmacology. They haven't got bionucleonics. As far as I know, they don't have clinical pharmacy. And while they have pharmacognosy, it's weak. Now, I claim you have to have this, you have to have the total program if you're going to have a strong school. Michigan has come upgrade, but it has been Well, it's only been a partial program, again, and a small school, relatively, although Michigan is excellent as a university. I think Ohio State is well on the way to a stronger program, and very great strength in hospital pharmacy and the clinical pharmacy area. Minnesota has improved considerably, and Iowa is strong in industrial pharmacy and hospital pharmacy. Illinois suffers from being in that Cook County Medical Center, but I think they have the potential to be a great school. They're the only school in Illinois. Tremendous resources if somebody would develop them. But I think Purdue can be kept as the leader in the Big Ten.
How do we rate nationally, would you say?
Of course, I'm prejudiced, but I'd rate us number one.
Very good.
The outstanding school.
What other, outside of the Big Ten, what other schools are good? Are the schools, take them by region, New England, do they have good schools?
New England has pretty weak schools. The Massachusetts College of Pharmacy is the second oldest in the country and rates strongly. Down in Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy lives on its reputation. It is one of the oldest ones. North Carolina is coming up as a school on the eastern coast. Florida has been pretty good, but they have some oddball faculty down there. Let's see, in other parts, Seattle, Washington came up, but they get into, well, Dean Tyler could tell you a lot about that.
He didn't, but
He could, because he knows it, and they have, you see, there they have controversy with the medical school. They can't have their own pharmacology. They can't have this. They can't have biochemistry, because medical school has biochemistry. Minnesota, this is their trouble. Michigan, this is their trouble. They can't have pharmacology or biochemistry. Wisconsin finally got through its pharmacology, but it's weak. And this is because they're in competition with medicine. Ohio State, everybody over there, they have a professor of pharmacology, but they have to call him a professor of pharmacy, because the medical school has the title. There aren't many real strong graduate schools, although there are too many trying to be graduate schools. But I would say Wisconsin has been the strongest competition of Purdue. Seattle in there, Maryland has been fair, and North Carolina is fair. Michigan has to be rated in its areas as
anything good in the South, like Louisiana, or Texas, Oklahoma.
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I think Tennessee, in a way, has come up. They've gone commercial. That is, they're out after doing work for commercial houses, and peculiar setup. I don't think much of them. Maybe I'm downgraded them on that account.
All right. Well, now, is there anything else that we ought to talk about while we're on?
Oh my. Let's see. We have physical facilities taken care of for a while.
We've gone through the your. When did you retire, by the way?
I was due to retire at the end of June 1966, and I took terminal leave effective January 1, 1966.
Now, what have you done since then?
I have been completely retired. That is, I decided that I was not going to get over around the school and interfere. I was in one school where the old dean used to come around and interfere to the extent that they ordered him to stay off the campus. And I know a young dean coming in doesn't want the former one in the way.
Were you president of did you continue on national committees and so on?
No, I dropped everything. I resigned from them. And of course at that time Mrs. Jenkins became ill. She had osteoporosis and she's been very severely ill much of the time. So I simply withdrew from that. We weren't able to travel because of her illness. Mm-hmm. I became sort of a house boy, right word. She's able to, fortunately, she's back on her feet and able to do some things around. But I became in part the cook and the housekeeper and the cleaning boy, the yard man and the errand man. I still do the shopping and the laundry and these things, and I keep up with journals. I look after our business interests, such as they are, and I make a hobby of it almost. It is
sort of fun, isn't it?
Sort of fun, yes. Yeah. It keeps me surprising, you know, if you have to do all the work for the family, how much...
Yes, sir, how much there is.
There is. That is, I don't mean do all the work, but all the running and the tending to the detail. Well, and I take it easy, like in the morning.
Retirement has not been difficult, not way down.
Not at all. I get up in the morning, eat a leisurely breakfast, and sit and laugh as all the people hurry by to work. I read the morning paper, and after the mail comes, the Wall Street Journal, and if I'm not careful, first thing I know is noon.
Yeah.
And then in the afternoon, like today, I take... Took a little nap. We get up and we have our coffee in the afternoon. And I run out and shop or go down to school and pick up my journals, read them, and carry them back there and give them to the library.
Well, in other words, you live an active life.
Go to Rotary and to Town and Gown, some of my old associations I keep up. But mainly, I don't worry about anything. I've decided I've made the world over about as much as I could do it.
Well, that's very good. Now, we'll call the interview, if it's all right with you. Is there anything more you'd like to add?
Well, I will add a few things, like I headed a mission to Japan back in here to MacArthur's staff, but this was not connected with our school, especially.
Well, you'll put that in your activities.
I'll supplement the...
Very good.
Supplement the word. Oh. Now, this will come out in a typewritten form.
When you get it, first we will send you the rough draft, then you correct the rough draft and edit it. Add to it if you please,
yeah,
or detract.
Yeah, okay.
And then you send that back with the, your additions. And then that'll be it, and it will go into the, be bound and put into the Purdue University archives.
Fine.
Of course, you'll have a copy of it.
Well, then I'll start getting some copies.
All right.
Of material. You see, I have this biographical sketch.
All right.
Here, of the old type we used to put into who's who and so on.
Well, then, if this is all right, I will. This is an end of an interview on July 10th, 1972, recorded in the home of Dean Emeritus Glenn L. Jenkins of the School of Pharmacy and R.B. Eccles. Thank you very much, Dean Jenkins.